The Author Meets the Critic. It's The Author Meets the Critic, the original program where the author of a new book meets and exchanges his opinions with his severest critics, the nation's top book reviewers. And now here's the man who keeps the peace on these programs, your regular chairman, John K.M. McCaffrey.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you, Ken Banghart. Hundreds of thousands of American readers will remember Bruce Marshall's books, The World, The Flesh, and Father Smith, and Father Malachi's Miracle. The other day, Mr. Marshall's latest novel was released for publication. It is called Vespers in Vienna, and the Book of the Month Club has chosen it as one of its dual selections for August. Critics throughout the country are divided on Mr. Marshall's newest book, and to give you an idea of how drastically the reviewers have disagreed, we would like you to hear now from our critics of the afternoon. First, here is an opinion from Mr. Charles G. Paulding, literary editor of the Commonweal magazine.
Nobody is going to quarrel with the serious and thoughtful and at times moving half, but is it even a half, of Vespers in Vienna. But Mr. Marshall should have had the courage of his convictions. He should have written a serious book seriously, without the comic relief. He should have left all the P.G. Wodehouse Englishmen to P.G. Wodehouse. I find the book ruined because its serious message is presented by tolerably real characters to a series of totally unreal cliché characters out of contemporary British farce. All could have been fable, as it was in Voltaire with Candide, or else everything and all the people in the book should be real.
There you have one critic's opinion. Let's hear now from the other side, the executive secretary of the Institute for American Democracy, the well-known Episcopal clergyman, Father William C. Kernan.
I like this new novel by Bruce Marshall. I recommend it to everyone who believes that a good novel ought to tell a good story, while at the same time it assumes that people who read it have brains and enjoy using them. We have here a good story dealing with issues important to all men everywhere. The need for discipline to prevent man from falling to the level of the beasts. The need for moral reformation. The need for good authority to save humanity from chaos and anarchy. The need for love, which is of the spirit.
Well, in a little while we will hear what our author, Bruce Marshall, has to say in answer to his critics. But first, here is a word from Ken Banghart.
This series of broadcasts, sponsored by the Book of the Month Club, is directed to everyone interested in good books, and particularly to the thousands of members of the Book of the Month Club in this area. The book to be discussed today, Vespers in Vienna by Bruce Marshall, was recently published by Houghton Mifflin and selected by the Book of the Month Club judges as one of the two books for August. The other half of this current dual selection is The Last Days of Hitler by H.R. Trevor Roper, published by Macmillan. Both of these important new books were reviewed in the midsummer edition of the Book of the Month Club News. As all club members know, the Book of the Month Club News each month reports on the best of the new books. Reading the news regularly is the way club members keep abreast of important reading and make certain that they don't miss any of the vital new books. You can get a copy of the Book of the Month Club News even if you do not have membership in the club by writing to the Book of the Month Club in care of station WNBC, New York 20, New York. And now back to John McCaffrey.
Well, Father Kernan, what do you think of this analysis of a book that you like so much by Mr. Paulding, in which he says, implies very strongly that the characters belong in P.G. Wodehouse? As a matter of fact, I would think that you two men were almost describing different books. Father Kernan?
I don't think that these characters belong in P.G. Wodehouse or any place else but in this book. I believe that they belong here because they illustrate the very character of the kind of book that the author is trying to present to us. It is the life of an occupation army in a conquered zone, the zone being the Austrian one. And necessarily, things are bound to be chaotic under those circumstances. The characters, so far as I'm concerned, are real characters. It is true that Mr. Marshall has a facility for presenting a real character with a few brief strokes of his pen. But this, in my judgment, does not legislate at all against his ability to make his characters real.
Mr. Spaulding,
I'd like to pick up that phrase about the few brief strokes of his pen. It's generally somebody else's pen. Take Audrey, who's a British subaltern or something, or some what we'd call a whack, who goes around as a secretary in the army. And now she's straight out of the pen that wrote The Girl with the Green Hat 20 years ago, and she's lost her courage and strength, whatever it was, very romantic courage and strength, but it's gone, crossed with the pen that wrote Nita Luce's pen. Whenever she says something really silly and screamingly funny, it sounds to me like something that I heard 20 years ago.
In other words, this is a blonde in a green hat, and gentlemen in this book consistently prefer her. Would you
Mr. McCaffrey, I wish I could say it the way you do.
I'm sorry, Mr. Pauley, that the rebuke was called for.
I think that probably the explanation of this coincidence, if we may call it such, is that a character like Audrey turns up in every period of history.
Well, certainly she turns up at the present time, and I believe that 20 years ago, she was also a common character on the in the current scene of those days.
Father,
but she's a real character. The point that I'm making is this, that this character is a real character. If you'd never read P.G. Wodehouse, for example, this girl would still be a real character, and there's evidence to show it.
All right.
Supposing she is a real character, she's an abysmally dull one, and I don't see why Bruce Marshall, who's talking seriously, has to talk seriously anywhere in the neighborhood of such a silly fool.
Well, Mr. Marshall is not writing, of course, a theological or a philosophical essay.
No, he's wrapping up a message and with a lot of sugar candy around it, but I think it's unfair to concentrate on this little girl. Take the nuns. Take somebody out of the really serious half of the book, because I admit there's a serious half of the book. Now, those nuns are to me a cliché. They're a reverse cliché. I'm getting tired of people who are astonished because women who go into convents are discovered to know why they went into convents and to believe the faith that they practice. Well, that seems to me a very tiresome and boring attitude, which is Mr. Marshall's constantly. He's amazed at everything that every other people knew a long time except conservative Britishers who never heard of religion or Christianity.
Well, I, of course, don't agree with that at all because, of course, Mr. Marshall has plenty of evidence in his book that he has heard of religion and particularly Christianity.
He's still surprised every day of his life.
Well, of course, the whole explanation of that, Mr. Pauline, is this, that whereas you, whereas I, and I am sure Mr. McCaffrey, understand the nature of the life of a nun and the reasons why nuns become nuns.
I'm interested in the note of doubt that came into your voice when you mentioned my name, Father Kinahan, but go ahead.
Well, maybe we can go into that later, Mr. McCaffrey. But there are countless people, I should say the majority of people in this country, who are not Catholics at least, who have no conception whatsoever as to why nuns become nuns. I had an illustration of that this morning. I was teaching a Bible class, and there were people there who knew nothing about Catholicism. And the questions they asked were precisely the questions with which Mr. Marshall deals in this book, and which you say everybody knows everything about. I assure you everybody does not know about the subject matter with which he's dealing here. It's very realistic to me, while at the same time it's very human.
Well, I think that you people, both of you, have raised such questions, and that Mr. Marshall knows about a good many of them, and that we should bring on our author, Mr. Bruce Marshall, the author of Vespers in Vienna, who will come to us via transcription.
This is NBC London with a special recording by Mr. Marshall requested from New York to answer criticisms of his recent book. Mr. Marshall will be going ahead in 10 seconds.
Samson's strength is reliably stated to have been proportionate to the length of his hair. And in case my ability to reply to criticism might be concealed behind a similar relationship, I decided to postpone a much-needed visit to the barber until I had read Mr. Pauling's and Mr. Kernan's reviews of Vespers in Vienna. Let me say at once that I was relieved by my critic's clemency, especially by that of Mr. Kernan, who understood my purpose so well that I can say only, thank you, Mr. Kernan. Mr. Pauling chides me for not having written a serious book without comic relief, for not having left P.G. Woodhouse characters to P.G. Woodhouse, and for having been timid and coy about my own beliefs. As regards the first charge, I shall defend myself by saying that in life, as William Shakespeare realized before me, blood, tears, and sweat neither inevitably nor invariably exclude gaiety or even humor. And tragedy is saddened rather than gladdened by the juxtaposition of comedy, as Sean O'Casey showed when he wrote The Shadow of a Gunman. At any rate, I can assure Mr. Paulding that such was the case in Vienna in 1945 and 1946, when the tragedy of displaced persons was played to an accompaniment of non-functioning telephones and stupid misunderstandings, at which one had to laugh if one was not to weep all the time with Rachel. As I have rarely been abused by P.G. Woodhouse's characters, I take Mr. Paulding's second charge more seriously. Although my characters are imaginary, their characteristics are not, and their manner of acting and talking is, I maintain, as near to the real McCoy as my poor pen can make it. If my British staff officers merit the reproach of stock character, then I can assure Mr. Paulding that, despite Alexander, Montgomery, and Victory, the stock has not yet gone out of stock. The existence of ordinary people is not brought to a stop by the previous portrayal in fiction. And in 1945 and 1946, the Sergeant Moonlights and Senior Subaltern Audrey Quayles of the British Army went on being their limited selves even while the rumblings of revolution reverberated around them. And what was Colonel Nicobar but a miniature Alexander Montgomery with a high sense of responsibility in his soul? Finally, soldiers are still timid and coy about stating their beliefs, and as it was their belief rather than my own that I was mostly reproducing, I had to be timid and coy too. Nevertheless, I thank Mr. Paulding for understanding that the purpose of Vespers in Vienna is serious, although I thank Mr. Kernan still more because it was his total comprehension which finally sent me off to the barber with a glow in my heart.
Well, this is one of the infrequent authors we have on the program who comes out of this with a glow in their heart, and I suppose that that is a tribute to Mr. Marshall's amiability rather than to anything else. Well, Mr. Paulding, I think that we dumped this pretty squarely right back into your lap. What do you think of Mr. Marshall's criticism of your criticism?
Well, I think he was extremely kind to my criticism, and it's all right. I'm sorry to hear that the British staff is exactly as it always was, but I deny that. I deny that. I don't think that you can have a class of men who can persist, I know they will in books, but who can persist forever as idiots, and yet out of that same class of men, Mr. Marshall alluded to what I said in our message to him, who can produce generals who win wars and who are men of deep religion. Montgomery is a man of great religious feeling. I don't think that you can suddenly say that there arises a phenomenon of an intelligent man out of the British staff. I think we've had enough making fun in the most absolutely trivial and exhausting way. This colonel here, for anybody who was in the other war, recalls inevitably Colonel Bramble. A Frenchman wrote a book after the end of the other war called The Silences of Colonel Bramble, in which this coy and reticent man of belief and kindness and a loud language, it's the same thing again and again, but it isn't very human. I think it's very tiresome myself.
Well, I would like to suggest that we get away for a moment or two from the characters in the book and that we come very sharply to the reasons for Mr. Marshall's writing it, the point of this book, the message of this book, if there is any. And Father Kernan, would you like to go into that a little?
The message of the book, of course, is that the world is never going to find peace and it's never going to eliminate war and it's never going to find social justice or any of the other things it talks so much about until it gets an eternal point of view, which point of view, the author points out very clearly, is held by the Church. This is symbolized by the permanence of the convent in the midst of everything which is tumbling to ruins about it. Throughout the war and after the war and when everything was miserable and the refugees were being thrown about from one country to another, the convent remains a source of peace and a source of light and strength and discipline. And all these things, the author says, are the things which we need. As he puts it, it's very important that everybody try his best every day to be as good as he can in a virile and heroic sense if the world is ever to find peace and tranquility. Now, of course, he has his doubts this can happen, but that's because he has a realistic view of human nature. While he knows that human nature is fallible due to original sin and is therefore weak, At the same time, he recognizes that the grace of God can overcome it if men will correspond with that grace. Now, that is an essential message that the world ought to know, and you have it very clearly in this book, as I think, presented in a stimulating fashion.
Mr. Paulding, how stimulating did you find it?
I thank Father Canaan precisely for giving the message, because I've always said the message was serious. What I say is that you can put a message into a pamphlet or into a sermon. Today's the day we've had the sermon. It also comes in into a book. But you cannot have a serious sermon delivered to... I come back to those characters. They aren't interesting. They'll bore anybody. But the point is you cannot be talked seriously on one half of the book to the people who aren't serious in their existence on the other half of the book without, for me, appearing to be a failure.
Well, in order that the people who are listening to us may not suppose that this book is divided into two parts, one of it serious and one of it humorous, let me say that the humor is, of course, interlarded throughout the pages of the book, and that's the way life is lived. If, as Colonel Nicobar did, the hero of this book, you yourself were placed in a monastery and talked to the nuns, you would not constantly be talking about serious things. You would be doing what all normal people do. You would be passing the time of day and saying humorous things as they occurred to you. Now I would like to quote one of them, if you don't mind, because I think it's appropriate. It's a very short quote. Colonel Nicobar, talking to Schwester Kashmira, says, "I'm a dab at dealing with reverend mothers, at least I think I am. That is to say, he's not used to being with nuns. After all, reverend mothers can't be so very different from sergeants major. And it's more than 20 years now since I was lost afraid of a sergeant major. That's when an officer really begins to know that he's an officer, when he's no longer afraid of the sergeant major." Well, now, that may be considered trivial if you like, but that's the way people talk. That's the way we all talk if we have any sense about us at all and any appreciation of proportion.
But has anybody in the world talked the way Reverend Mother Superior talks? What kind of language is that, Father Canaan?
Well, just
is
to what you refer.
Natural? I refer to every word that comes out of either her lips or out of the Austrian soldier's lips or the Russian colonel's lips.
Oh.
It's the same international pidgin English based on adoptive rhythms from the German. Will you please, Herr Oberst, she says, be allowing me to be remembering about the thing that I will soon be talking. I don't know. It's gibberish. And it's done...
Sounds like gibberish, Mr. Paulding.
Well, that's because of the way Mr. Paulding is reading it. You can read anything and make it sound like that.
Do you deny that he doesn't use that stylistic device?
No, he
precisely
does.
Precisely all through, and do you justify that device?
I don't deny that he... No, it isn't boring to me, at least it isn't.
Do you find it really funny?
Perhaps I'm just an unusual sort of a person who doesn't appreciate good literature or understand bad literature when I read it. I don't know. But I believe that what he's doing here is to adopt a device to convey to us that these people are foreign to our medium.
Yeah. Well, great writers usually let them speak in a language. Otherwise, it becomes the vaudeville stage with the end man talking.
Well, now, I would like to ask both of you your attitude toward a certain character in relation to the book and to the message of the book. Throughout the entire book, Colonel Nicobar remains a skeptic. He has what Mr. Marshall presents is a very pleasant skepticism of a very shy and inarticulate man who has had very little contact with religion. According to you, Father Canaan, Mr. Marshall is trying to get across the message that we need these things, that we need the spiritual revolution, and yet his own main character seems to be somewhat unaffected by that.
Well, I don't exactly agree with that, Mr. McCaffrey, because a lot of these things which the author says are necessary to the world's welfare, Colonel Nicobar already believes in. For instance, he insists upon the soldiers saluting him, not because he wants to be saluted, but because he hates slackness, and he says that through slackness or sloth, we're likely to lose our civilization, which, in my judgment, is a very profound thought. What he finds, as a matter of fact, is that the church represents these things which he has always believed.
I'm glad to see that Father Canaan recognizes the centurion theme when he sees it in literature. Very interesting. I don't want to give the impression, I'm extremely against this book as a work of art, but I don't want to give the impression that I'm against the message or against certain very clever things done by the author. And one of the cleverest of them is to avoid the pitfall of having the Colonel be converted to Catholicism throughout this book. He must remain doubtful, otherwise the book, that's what, in his own speech, in his London recording, he said soldiers have to be coy and diffident about what they say about religion. And I think it's a brilliant stroke that he left him where he was, doubting to the end, but stirred and worried. And that is an effective thing. It's the first compliment I've given.
Well, I think, though, that it is a deserved compliment, Mr. Paulding, and that it is, of course, a compliment based upon all that preceded it, for the reason that Colonel Nicobar could not have come to the end that he does in this book, still a skeptic, but warm toward religion, if everything preceding in the book had not been presented as Mr. Marshall has presented it. And all of that, of course, is the thing to which you object, and which I say is essential if we're going to have a well-knit novel, which we have here, Paul.
We have a novel so well-knit and so all-inclusive that it holds a character who has been in Punch ever since that comic magazine was founded, 300 or 400 years ago, perhaps. That is the illiterate Cockney. In this case, he happens to be a sergeant called Moonlight. Imagine calling. It's offensive to my sense of dignity of man.
Well,
to have a novel in which that stock character is pulled out and subjected. You see, Father Canaan, what's so sad is, now this colonel, we can think that he'll be converted a little while later off stage, but that fellow Moonlight is lost forever and ever and ever.
Well, Moonlight is a very minor character in the book. I remember that at the end of it, he writes a letter to the colonel saying...
He drops an H.
With reference to nothing whatsoever, that his father died, and he didn't know what kind of gases were in him, but at any rate, he blew up to a great size as he lay in the coffin. Well, that's Sergeant that's Moonlight, but Sergeant Moonlight is a minor character. I think that Sergeant Moonlight belongs in a book like this. Now, Mr. Marshall, as we have his word for it, says that since he himself was in Vienna in the post-war period, he ought to know something about what the people who lived there and who take part in the occupation were like. I believe that the characters he's presented here are lifelike and real.
Well, let's
and I believe, as I say again, there's evidence to prove it if we can introduce the evidence.
Well, what about the love affair? There is a love affair running throughout the entire book of this Russian girl and the story of her escape from the Russian zone, the love affair that she has with the British officer.
Called Twingo.
Well,
yeah.
That's a nickname. That's not his real name.
Well, I know that. His real name's Colonel McFimister, but they all talk to each other that way.
I wonder which is more... fantastic, the nickname or the actual name. But in any case, here is this love affair, and it is in that portion of the book that we get the best picture of the condition of the displaced persons, the horror of life in Europe. What did you think of those portions, Mr. Paulding?
Well, of course I like that. I'm moved even by what I read every morning in the New York Times as to what happens. But I admit that it's very useful in any book if it's dramatized and you do identify suffering with some person. However, that girl, even there, how sad it was, she has to die, and she dies as if she was singing Mimi and Bohème, that is, remembering the happy phrases of the past. And my goodness, that's a beautiful technical device for an opera. The music turns into minor and you have it. But for heaven's sakes, what she remembers is a phrase that Twingo taught her, and she dies saying, "Hold my hand like nobody's business."
Well,
that's a terrible letdown. Yeah. It is absolutely pathos or bathos or anything else you want. I don't like that kind of stuff.
All right, well, Father.
I would say, though, that the test of that is not whether or not we happen to like it, but whether or not it could happen and whether people are like that. After all, when a man writes a novel, he's supposed to be writing about people whom he has seen and whom he has known. Well, now, I believe that is a characterization that is certainly within the realm of possibility.
Well,
you've heard of people, I know you have, I've heard of them, everybody has, who, when they begin to learn words from a foreign language, use them in the most untoward and sometimes grotesque way.
But that's
which is
a very intimate
what's
detail
being having done here. And you're not presenting the whole picture here. The whole picture here, and by far the most important part of the picture, is that this Twingo finds that as a result of this girl's tragic death, he himself can believe in God as he never was able to believe in God before. That is, by living as he says and dying to God. That is precisely one of the things which, according to the author, and as I agree, and I'm sure that all the rest of us do at this table too, is what the world needs if it's to be saved from the destruction wrought by its own greed and by its own selfishness, and particularly by its own kind of carnal love. And that's the picture here. It isn't simply hold my hand like nobody's business.
Oh, I know it's a very beautiful death, but I think those intimate things, those intimate uses of foreign languages, at best remain intimate. They become silly in print.
One of the most terrible things about The Author Meets the Critics is that we always get to carnal love in the last 30 seconds of the program. If you people arrange these things a little better, why, we'd be able to fill out our time with perhaps more excitement. It is unfortunate, I think, that we haven't been able to cover all of the characters and to blend them into the actual situation of the message that Mr. Marshall is getting across in this book. Would either of you care to compare this book with two other books of Mr. Marshall's, both very successful and on similar themes, The World of Flesh and Father Smith and Father Malachi's Miracle?
Well, I'd like to say a word, if I may, about Father Smith. The story this story is similar to that one, although, as I remember it, Father Smith did not come precisely to the same conclusion that the author comes to here through the words of the Reverend Mother Auxilia. You remember that when she returns from Rome, she explains that the church is here primarily to preserve the truth and to convert as many people to it as she can, that she's not here entirely to reform the world because the resistance of man to that is quite impossible. But Father Smith, as I recall it in the book, the previous book by this author, did not come to that conclusion. He was still thinking that morality ought to be raised to a higher level and that the church ought to concern itself mainly with teaching people morality on that level.
Well, time's up. I'm sorry, gentlemen. It is up for both the author and the critics, and I'll be back in a minute to tell you about next week's program. But first, here is a word from our announcer.
You'll be interested to know that more than 300 books are usually offered to the Book of the Month Club each month by their publishers, and that each one of these 300 is carefully read before the choice of the Book of the Month can be made. Which one of these books is chosen as the selection is always left entirely to a board of 5 eminent literary craftsmen. A board of judges consisting of Henry Seidel Canby, Dorothy Canfield Fisher, Clifton Fadiman, John P. Marquand, and Christopher Morley. It's seldom realized, perhaps, that this board of judges has an enviable record over the years of finding writers who have subsequently made history. They pick the first successful books and thereby help bring richly deserved fame and fortune to such authors as Pearl Buck, Stephen Vincent Benet, John Gunther, Eric Maria Remarque, John Steinbeck, Jan Struther, Lin Yutang, Clarence Day, William L. Shirer, Franz Werfel, and many, many others. Most members, of course, have read the review of Vespers in Vienna, the book we're discussing today, in the Book of the Month Club News. Each month in the news, the current selection and 70 or more other important new books are reviewed by experts. Books which may be secured either through the club or through your local bookstore. As a supplement to this news, a special section describes nearly 30 new and worthwhile books which may be chosen by members in addition to or instead of the regular selection, with the same dividend credit as the regular selection. If you are not now a member of the club, you may get a free copy of the current issue of the Book of the Month Club News by writing to the Book of the Month Club, care of station WNBC, New York 20, New York. Now, Mr. McCaffrey, what lies ahead on The Author Meets the Critics?
Well, in the spring of 1941, a great many top-flight literary critics devoted a great deal of space to welcoming a first novel of a new young writer. The novel was What Makes Sammy Run and the author Bud Schulberg. Bud Schulberg has a new novel out, which you surely have heard about during the past few weeks. It's a hard-hitting story of the prize-fighting business, or, in the words of the publishers, a relentless disclosure of the fight racket. A great many people have found it entertaining and exciting, but a lot of the inhabitants of Jacob's Beach are up in arms about The Harder They Fall by Bud Schulberg. We anticipate a hard-hitting program next week when Bud Schulberg meets his critics. And now, before closing, I'd like to thank Father William C. Kernan, Mr. Charles G. Spaulding, for coming here this afternoon and for joining us. This is John K. M. McCaffrey saying good afternoon for The Author Meets the Critics.
The Author Meets the Critics is produced by Martin Stone. This is Kenneth Banghart speaking.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.